You're listening to Good Sentences, the podcast that's guaranteed to tickle your literary ear holes and make you wish you'd listened to dear old mom when she said to put down those lawn darts and learn how to read. And now, here are your hosts, neither of whom listened to dear old mom. This is Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.
It's an honor to have J.A. Jantz on the show. Now, we've had a series going on the podcast lately, which we've been talking about character creation, character motivations. Now, you've created a ton of characters over the years, but the two, I guess, that stand out in my mind are J.P. Beaumont and Joanna Brady. Now, am I correct in thinking that J.P. Beaumont was the first major character of yours?
J.P. Beaumont was the first when I wrote the first Beaumont book in 1982 and 83. I thought I was writing a standalone book. I had no idea the publisher was going to purchase it at the beginning of a series. And I had even less idea that close to 40 years later, I would have published 24 Beaumont books and lots of other books besides.
But that's incredible. So when you started out writing that first book, was this something you wanted to do as a career?
I wanted to be a writer from the time in second grade when I read the Wizard of Oz books. I didn't care much about the wizard hiding behind the curtain. What I was fascinated by was Frank Baum hiding behind the words. That's what I wanted to do. I grew up and won a scholarship to the University of Arizona because I wanted to be a writer. I signed up to be an English major. And then in 1964, when it was time for the upper division courses, I tried to enroll in the creative writing course, and the professor said, "You're a girl." And I said, "So?" He said, "Girls become teachers or nurses, boys become writers," and he wouldn't let me into his class. So, origins of character. When I wrote my first hardback 10 years into my career, Hour of the Hunter, the crazed killer turns out to be a former professor of creative writing from the University of Arizona. My position on characters is that it has to be someone you care about in either direction. Mm-hmm. You either have to love them or you needed to hate them. But I'd like to tell you how I met J.P. Beaumont, because essentially we met on a train. I had spent 6 months trying to write what would be the first Beaumont book through the point of view of the wrong character. So in 1983, when spring break came around, I sent my two kids to Camp Orkaila up on the island, and I sent myself to Portland to spend several days with a friend from my days in the life insurance business. And as I got onto the train, I had a stack of Blue Line notebooks. I had this full of ballpoint pens. And as the train pulled out of the station, I thought, what would happen if I wrote this book through the detective's point of view? And so I picked up a pen and I wrote, "She might have been a cute kid once. That was hard to tell now. She was dead."
Oh.
From that very moment, I was with J.P. Beaumont at the crime scene. I was walking around in his shoes. I was seeing it through his eyes, hearing what other people said to him, hearing what he said, but also hearing what was going on in his head. And we've been together ever since.
That's really cool.
By the way, Unto Proven Guilty was published as an original paperback in 1985. It's still in print, so it's actually historical fiction now. Nobody has cell phones. Nobody ever heard of DNA. It's still in print. And if you read the first page, you'll find that although I got a computer in 1983, and I never went back to that handwritten copy until after the book was published. But you'll see that the book starts just that way.
A writer, and even a reader, hopefully down the road, can get to know or feel that they know a character so well that they have the same love for that character as they do a quote-unquote real person. It's incredible how literature, and it's really a testament, as Scott and I were talking on another episode, a testament to the power of literature that it can do that for us.
Well, and it can take us to another place. I have countless emails from people who have found respite from a loved one, say, in intensive care, the loss of a loved one when you can't sleep afterwards, who found comfort in picking up with my stories. And going to my characters' lives get away from their own. And that's what stories are. Stories, the ancient sacred charge of the storyteller is to beguile the time. Time in hospital waiting room is time desperately in need of beguiling.
When you have a character as beloved to both you and readers as J.P. Beaumont, what made you decide to create another major character?
I have limited attention span. I could never be. I could never be Sue Grafton. I could never set out and chart myself the self-imposed course of writing 26 books about the same character. And I'm so sorry she didn't move beyond Y. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
We lost Sue Grafton and Kinsey Millhone before that journey was finished. But after 9 books, I was bored with J.P. Beaumont. And I threatened to knock him off. My editor said, oh, please don't do that. So I had written a book earlier, before I wrote Until Proven Guilty. It was a fictionalized version of an encounter my first husband and I had with a serial killer in Tucson in 1970. When I wrote that story, I wasn't allowed in the creative writing program, so I didn't know you should leave some things out. So I put everything in. And the manuscript ended up being 1,300 pages long. I actually found an agent, and I went to see her with my manuscript in a box. And she looked at the box, and she looked at me, and she said, this is your first book? And I said, yes. She didn't even touch it. She said, it's too long. Cut it in half. So I did. And she started sending it out after I cut it in half. She sort of had to. I did just what she said. And no one ever bought that book. The editors who turned it down said that the stuff that was fiction was fine, and the stuff that was real was unbelievable and would never happen, even though it had already happened.
Right.
So eventually, Alice, my agent, told me, well, why don't you write something that's totally fiction? So I wrote that first Beaumont book. Mm-hmm. So now, after 9 books, my editor said, well, you remember that first book you wrote, the one nobody ever bought? And I said, yes. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, why don't you rework that and we'll turn that into your first hardback? So I said, okay. So they sent me a check. They sent me a contract, all of that stuff. They gave me a deadline. But I had a real problem with that book because the real killer, a guy who murdered 3 people at 20 minutes after 2 on the 22nd day of the month, was then and still is in prison in Florence, Arizona. And I didn't want to write a book that would make him look at me.
Right.
So I had a contract. I had a paycheck. I had a deadline, and I didn't have a bad guy. And then my University of Arizona alumni magazine came out, and there was this little box article at the back that said, the newly recreated creative writing program at the University of Arizona is just going swimmingly. And I turned to my husband, my second husband, the nice one, and I said, you know, I've written all these books now. I graduated from the U of A. Maybe they'd like me to come down to Arizona and be writer in residence for a semester in the sun. He said, well, call him up, ask him. So I sold life insurance for 10 years. I'm not afraid of making a cold call. So I got the number from information. I called him up. I told them who I was, what I did. Didn't they want me to come be writer in residence? And the guy on the phone told me, and this is a direct quote, oh, we don't do anything with genre fiction here. We only do literary fiction.
God.
You know what? It was a miracle. I was healed of writer's block on the spot. And the former creative writing professor from the U of A went smack dab into my book. And people have told me that Andrew Philip Carlyle is one of the scariest people, characters they've ever met. Right up there with that guy in Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, God. Oh, I love it.
So now I wrote that book. I went back to write Beaumont. It was fun again. Believe it or not, this is a very long answer to your question. My husband says, Judy, with you, there are no short answers. There are only long answers. So I wrote the next Beaumont book, and my editor saw that I was a happy camper again. And he said, okay, why didn't you come up with another character so Beaumont can alternate with that other character? When I started writing about Beaumont, I had lived in Seattle for less than a year. Bo was a Seattle native. He was a homicide cop. I've never been a police officer. He was male. I've never been that either. And so writing those books in the first person took real concentration and effort. So I thought, okay, if I'm going to have another character, how about if I set it someplace I'm familiar with? I grew up in southeastern Arizona. I know the landscape. I know distances. I know timing. I know speed limits. I know roads. I know history. Then I thought, okay, writing about a male protagonist, especially from the first person, is challenging. So why don't I write this in the third person? And why don't I have a female protagonist? So what you can't see from where you are and where I am, and what you can't tell about me from my book covers, is I'm 6 feet 1 inch tall. And wow. I've always wondered what it would be like to be short. So I made Joanna short. She is 5'4". Sometimes my memory bank, my little gray cells slip a little, and her height has varied a couple of times by about 2 inches, but we're pretty much set on 5'4 now. But by making her short, when I write about her, I always have to see the world through her point of view. And so I know things about the top of Joanna Brady's refrigerator that she will never guess.
Right.
So that's where Joanna Brady came from. Yeah. And right now I'm working on Joanna Brady number 19, a book called Missing and Endangered that's due out next fall.
Fantastic.
But then here I go again. In 2000, I am sick and tired of all of my characters. And I was see what I mean about Sue Grafton? I was whining on the phone to my editor, and she said, okay, Judy, here's the deal. Why don't you write a book? It can be a new character, an old character, set it wherever you like. Just have it here by the 1st of January, and we'll publish it as a mass market paperback sometime when we can fit it into the schedule. So that was May. They wanted it by January. I can write a book between May and January. I signed a contract. They sent me a check. They gave me a deadline. And then I had writer's block.
Oh, no.
May and June passed. June and July passed. August and September. Suddenly, it was the middle of October, and I still had idea who was going to be in that book. So we were in Tucson. When I have writer's block, I tend to compulsively watch the news. In the middle of October, on a Thursday, when it was time for the new news, it was writer's block time. So I went to watch the news, and my favorite news broadcaster in Tucson was on the air. So she was on the air at noon. She was someone who graduated from the U of A. She had worked for KVOA from the time she was in college. And so watched the noon news. She was there. And then at 5 o'clock, I still had writer's block. And when I went to watch the 5 o'clock news, she was nowhere to be found. They didn't say she was on special assignment. She was just AWOL. So over the weekend, the other news outlets let it be known that between the noon news and the 5 o'clock news, her 35-year-old brand new news director came to her desk, told her she was past her pull-pie date, she was too old to be on TV, and escorted her from the building. You shouldn't make mystery writers mad because we have our ways of getting even. And within minutes, I was writing about Allie Reynolds being plucked from her news anchor desk in L.A. and being cast adrift at age, guess what, 53. Huh. And so I'm just doing the copy editing on Allie Reynolds number 15. I have essentially four different sets of characters, Beaumont, the Walkers, the Brady books, and the Allie Reynolds books. I think that really helps keep me fresh because when I go back to one of those other characters, I've been away for a while and I'm interested to see what's happening with them now and what's been happening with them while my back was turned. There was one time when Joanna Brady's mother eloped during our hiatus. And when Joanna Brady found out her mother had eloped, she almost wrecked the car and I almost dropped my computer.
Beaumont and Brady are both actual law enforcement or retired in Beaumont's case. Reynolds is not. What are the pros and cons now of having a character available to you who isn't official law enforcement?
Well, I didn't know I was writing police procedurals until 3 books in when my editor told me. As far as I was concerned, I was writing mystery. Then when it was time to write the Joanna Brady book, my initial assumption was that she would be an amateur sleuth. But then I got into writing it. And she is at home on page one, book one, waiting for her husband to come home so they can go out and celebrate their 10th wedding anniversary. And her smart daughter, Jenny, who is nine, has just had sex ed at school and figured out that there aren't enough months between the wedding anniversary and her birth date. And she asked her mom if she was dreaming. But the reason her husband, Andy, is late is he's lying down in the road on High Lonesome Road because somebody shot him. And he was a deputy sheriff at the time he was shot and killed. And he was also running for the office of sheriff. So she's trying to find out what really happened to her husband. And there's a lot of pushback in the department. But there was a lot of pushback for me, too, because every time she asked a question or tried to do something, I'd say, wait a minute, you can't do that. You're not a cop. That, you can't ask that question. You can't do that. So finally, I said, okay, she is not going to be an amateur sleuth. And at the end of the book, at Andy's funeral, someone comes up to her and says, how about if you run in your husband's stead to become sheriff? Well, her father used to be sheriff. Her husband was a deputy sheriff. And so she agrees. And sure enough, she wins. So she becomes sheriff. And everybody thinks it's sort of a sympathy vote. And she's just going to be sheriff in name only. And, and it's kind of what the county owes her. But then in the second book, Tombstone Courage, she makes one of the 10 fatal errors that police officers make, and that's Tombstone Courage, not waiting for backup. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I thought, she needs to learn how to be a cop.
Right.
So in the next book, I sent her out, off to the police academy in Phoenix, where she could really learn to be a professional police officer. So years passed, and I was down in Phoenix doing a book signing, and this crusty old lady in the audience says, my father was a doctor. My husband was a doctor. But that doesn't mean I can be a doctor. And just because Joanna Brady's father was a sheriff and her husband was a sheriff doesn't mean she can be a sheriff. And I looked at her and I said, well, did you read the book where she goes to the police academy? She said, no, I don't like those books.
Okay, then.
Last night, I received an email from someone who wrote to me about one of the characters in Until Proven Guilty. In Until Proven Guilty, at the time I was writing it, I had some family members who had gotten involved with a cult. And so when I decided to write this book, I decided to create a cult where the leader of self-same cult, Reverend Brody, used scripture to justify all kinds of really revolting behavior. So that book was written in 1982 and 83. It came out in 1985. This is 2020. When the book came out, I was afraid my family members would be insulted, but they read the book and they loved it. It never occurred to them that I was writing about them. But this past week, that cult leader has resurfaced in my life in an ugly fashion and passed on baloney. And a reader wrote to me saying, you need to, we have been chatting about that incident. And she said, well, you know, you need to take a step back. This sounds too much like Reverend Brody. And I thought, holy crap, it is. I really did model that character after that man. And that man did exactly the same kind of revolting things that I had written about, but I didn't find out about them until years later. It's really spooky to me when my artistic sensibilities seem to be able to peer into the future. One of my favorite characters right now is a character named Frigg, and Frigg happens to be an AI. My husband, my second one, the first one who was allowed in the creative writing program was the guy who told me in 1968, there's only going to be one writer in our family, and I'm it.
Oh, geez.
So my second husband is a lot nicer than that. He says that my first husband set the bar so low that it has made his life. Okay. Bill is a retired electronics engineer. He actually built the first brick-sized cell phone for Motorola in 1968 without benefit of integrated circuits. But it didn't. He built it in 1968, just exactly the size and shape of that gray brick phone that went on sale in the mid 80s.
Right.
But so he's your basic electronics genius, and he reads all this stuff that my liberal arts mind could never penetrate. So a few years ago, he says to me, "You know, AI is really interesting. You should write a book about AI." And I said, "Are you talking to me?" But he planted the idea, and pretty soon, I'm writing a book called Men Overboard, where the killer is this computer genius who likes, his name is Owen, but he likes to refer to himself as Odin. And he creates an AI, which he calls Frigg, to be his computerized partner in crime. Frigg sort of grew on me. And over the course of the book, as Odin was going farther and farther into the deep, and I could see that he was just going to fall off the edge because he was losing it. He was no longer listening to Frigg's advice. He was supposed to be plan his strategy, which he suddenly began ignoring. And I thought, well, the end of Odin is going to be the end of Frigg too. And actually, that's what I thought. I wrote the book, but as Odin goes farther and farther afield, Frigg starts taking steps to preserve herself. In the deep learning, somehow she has learned about self-preservation. By the end of the book, she's more than prepared to throw Odin to the wolves as long as she can keep on keeping on. At the time I wrote that book, my editor was a woman of a certain age in New York City who only used her BlackBerry. And I thought, she's going to get halfway through this manuscript. She's going to throw it over her shoulder. She's going to say, "Call Judy, get our money back. We're never going to publish it." And that is not what happened.
Thankfully.
She finished the manuscript. She called me up and she said, "Don't kill Frigg. You can't kill Frigg." Which is how come Frigg is still around three books later. But shortly after that book came out, Bill was reading one of his scientific articles. And he handed me one. It turns out that some Google AI engineers who were playing video games with their AIs noticed that if they stopped taking their AI's advice, the AI started to cheat. Mm. And I thought, bingo, I called that shot.
Yep.
This conversation has been a brief history of the origins of almost all of my characters.
Nicely done. I'm currently reading the A-list, and so I am pretty infatuated with Allie as a character. She's incredibly deep, multi-layered. She's essentially had to reinvent herself numerous times. Was that process something that evolved for you, or did you envision it right from the get-go with her?
I had no idea. Mm. You have to understand, I encountered outlining in Mrs. Watkins' sixth grade geography class in Bisbee, Arizona. I hated outlining then. Nothing that has happened to me in the intervening decades has changed my mind. So I don't outline my books, and I certainly don't outline my theory. So no, her evolution has evolved. But I think her evolution is a reflection of my own evolution. If you had met me in 1975 and 76, you would have found me living in a mobile home, a 14 by 70 single wide on my folks' back lot in Bisbee Junction, Arizona, struggling and selling life insurance, dreaming of being a writer, but with no hope of doing that. If you had seen me in 1980, struggling with divorcing my husband, who, by the way, died of chronic alcoholism at age 42, a year and a half after I divorced him. But at the time I was contemplating a divorce, would I be able to feed my kids? Would I be able to keep a roof over my head? I didn't know what those answers would be.
Right.
And then when I left Arizona with my kids in the back seat and all our worldly possessions loaded into a U-Haul trailer behind, I had no idea that I would come to Seattle to a new life that would mean when we come home from a Disney cruise at the end of March, we'll be flying home on a private jet. Mm. I didn't know.
Right.
I had no idea that my U-Haul trailer would end up turning into a private jet.
That's a nifty trick.
But I think Allie's life has evolved into something she never imagined, just as my life has evolved into something I never imagined. Mm. But I think for both of us, we value the journey.
Right.
We notice the journey. It isn't right. just getting to the destination. Now, I have to ask you a question about the A-list. How far are you into the A-list?
I haven't gotten very far, so I'm about 100 pages in.
That book has a lot to do with kidney disease. Kidney disease is the subplot of that book. What is ironic is at the time I was writing that book, I sit in my chair in the family room writing. My husband sits in his chair in the family room, and when I finish a chapter, he reads it. Uh-huh. And he had back surgery in October, and he seemed to be recovering pretty well. And then in November, he started not really recovering. He sort of plateaued, and then he lost his appetite. All kinds of things were just haywire. He was grumpy. He was, but I was still writing. He was still reading. There comes a point in the Allie Reynolds books where one of the parents involved tells Allie about her daughter's symptoms shortly before she died of acute kidney failure.
Right.
So we're walking along. My husband has now reached a point in early December where the only things he wants to eat are eggnog and lemonade. Fortunately, it was Christmas. You could buy eggnog. But because he wasn't eating anything, he was losing a lot of weight, and he was happy about that. So every day he posts his weight on Fat Secret. And on the 17th of December, Fat Secret sent him a message saying, "You are losing weight too fast. Call your doctor." Uh-huh. We called the doctor. We did an ultrasound. And the next day he was in the ER with an acute kidney failure with 14% kidney function.
Wow.
If we had waited another day, he wouldn't have made it. Yeah. And that app actually literally saved his life, because having his phone tell him he needed to see his doctor was a lot more effective than having me tell him he needed to see his doctor. A few weeks later, between Christmas and New Year's, right at that time, I was doing the copy editing of that book. And I got to that passage where the mother tells Allie about her daughter's symptoms.
Right.
And the hair literally stood up on the back of my neck, because I researched the symptoms. I wrote them into the book without realizing they were sitting in the chair right next to me.
Well, it's been incredible to have you on the show. And you are, in my mind, a real inspiration to people, and not just who might be facing similar circumstances, but anybody who might be facing some sort of roadblock that they feel may not be able to overcome, or something that they feel is holding them back. But you have shown that you can overcome whatever's in your way. I mean, and the researching for this show, I did some reading, but hearing you talk about it brings it all home, and it's an incredible story. And I really thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, I'd like to add one more piece of the puzzle. I bought my first computer in 1983. It was an Eagle computer, a dual floppy, not steam driven, but close, with 128K of memory.
Whoa,
right. But the guy who sold it to me fixed it. So every morning when I booted up the computer, these are the words that flashed across the screen. A writer is someone who has written today. And those words were an incredible gift to me when I thought I was a writer and nobody else believed it. And I think they're a gift I pass along to other writers who are starting out. Yeah. And I have to say, right this minute today, I have 3,830 steps. I've been to the dentist. I will be taking my dog to PT, but right now I am not a writer, because today I haven't written a damn word.
We'll still consider that we've talked to a writer and one of the greatest writers as well. So thank you so much for indulging us. Again, talking about character in January, and you've blown the discussion wide open. I really appreciate you joining us here on Good Sentences.
Thank you for inviting me.